The Crimopedia podcast is a completely independent show that explores content of a potentially violent and disturbing nature. Please use your listening discretion. Extra trigger warning for this episode. We will be discussing missing and murdered Indigenous women and some history around the injustices faced by Indigenous peoples in Canada, both past and present. Hi everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Crimopedia podcast. I'm your host, Allison, and today we're going to be talking about a case that, like many others in the series about MMIWG2S+, there's not a whole lot of information about. However, as I've done with all of the other cases in this series, I'm going to use the story of Sharon Frances Maristy to speak about the broader contexts of issues leading to the disproportionate violence experienced by Indigenous women, girls, and people at large. So with that, please bear with me as the actual story I'm going to be telling today is a bit short, but the larger context is a little bit longer, and to me is an issue that continues to surprise me how little people know about it. So with that, we are going back to December of 1993 in the province of Saskatchewan to talk about Sharon Frances Maristy and how she may or may not have been a victim of the Starlight Tours. So, let's jump right in. Back in December of 1993, Sharon Frances Maristy was 18 years old. She was an Indigenous woman, although there isn't much information about her Indigenous background. To me, I find this quite odd because there are interviews with her mother and interviews with police who were involved in investigating her case, but nonetheless, all of the articles I could find about her case only specified that she was Indigenous. December 3rd, 1993 was a Friday night, and so she was out visiting a house party with some friends on Elphinstone Street in Regina in the province of Saskatchewan. In all of the reports I've read, Sharon was reportedly seen drinking, but when she was seen leaving the party at around 3:30 in the morning, technically on December 4th, it's pretty unclear if she was super drunk or if she was even intoxicated at that point at all. But what is clear is that she did leave the party, and she went walking. Another big point in this case that's unclear is what happened to Sharon for 18 hours before she was found the next day. At approximately 10:30 p.m., two individuals on snowmobiles discovered the frozen body of Sharon Frances Maristy on the edge of Wascana Creek, which runs through almost the entire city of Regina in Saskatchewan, at a site that was about 5 kilometers or about 3-ish miles away from the house that she was seen leaving. Sharon had showed up to the party wearing blue jeans, a white t-shirt, a checkered flannel jacket, and black shoes. When she was found the next day, she was seen wearing the same clothes: blue jeans, a white t-shirt, a checkered flannel jacket, and black shoes, one of which was missing when she was found but was later apparently recovered nearby. Despite being effectively frozen solid, Sharon Frances Maristy was transported to hospital, where efforts to revive her with CPR continued for about 3 hours until she was finally declared deceased. An autopsy conducted on Sharon's body concluded that she died of hypothermia, which frankly comes as no surprise as she was found laying in the cold. Her outfit that night did not reflect the attire of someone who was prepared to face the icy temperatures, especially for that long, given she had been found at 10:30 p.m. the next day. Given that, it's pretty clear that she didn't intend on walking around for that long or being outside for that long. But it's unclear whether or not she planned on being outside really at all. Nobody knows if she was waiting for a car or a cab or something like that. A piece of information that I'd like to know before I come to any conclusions would be where she lived in proximity to this house party. I know from personal experience that when you're drinking, walking home seems a bit more feasible, regardless of where you live, but it's unclear to me if that's sort of what Sharon's line of thinking was, because again, we don't even know if she was drunk still at the point that she left. But regardless, given that they clearly are privy to much more information than we are, Regina police ruled out foul play in her case, with her body showing no signs of maltreatment. Interestingly though, police didn't close their investigation until much, much later. Almost 15 years after Sharon's body was found, Regina police issued a public plea for information on her case. In an article that I read by the CBC, a spokesperson for the case of Sharon Maristee, Elizabeth Popowicz, said that the time between Sharon's last sighting and the time that she was found does play a key role into their investigation. Quote, "There's still that period of time where we don't know if anybody saw her or spoke to her or had contact with her. And maybe the reason we don't know is that nobody had contact with her in that time, but we're trying to find out. It would be reassuring to be able to provide some answers so we can say with certainty exactly how and why Frances Maristee came to be in Northwest Regina by herself, out in the cold." This is essentially where Sharon Frances Maristee's story ends. Although I will say the comments by Elizabeth Popowicz do allude to the fact that Sharon likely lived quite far away from the house party she was trying to leave from. And although it's entirely possible that she did die as a result of drinking and being desensitized to the cold, her mother doesn't buy it. She doesn't believe that her daughter died by accident. Quote, "I think someone took her over there and threw her away, left her there to die." I speak about the case of Sharon Maristee today, not because I necessarily know what happened to her, but because regardless of whether it's related or not, her case reminds me a lot of something called a starlight tour. In the province of Saskatchewan here in Canada, between the 1990s and early 2000s, dating back as early as 1976, First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people were being found frozen to death on the outskirts of large cities, mostly Saskatoon and Regina. Saskatoon Police Service in particular, and likely others, were arresting Indigenous people, usually males, without cause, citing alleged drunk and disorderly behavior, and driving them to the outskirts of the city at night in the winter and abandoning them, leaving them to die or almost die trying to get home. This practice is called starlight tours, and it's been documented for decades and only came to light after the Saskatoon Police Service was caught. There are a lot of parallels between Sharon Maristee's case and the typical order of operations with which a starlight tour would take place. The only difference really is a gendered one, but that doesn't seem to matter to most police services who undertook starlight tours as a practice, as we'll come to learn. Firstly, what's baked into the starlight tours as a practice is a stereotype based on drinking. Stereotyping itself typically needs no elaboration due to biases baked into society, and thus is pretty self-explanatory, given that they are baked in again to the institutions with which civil servants such as police officers operate within. In the case of Indigenous people found frozen to death, they've always been viewed as suspicious, at least in the eyes of the public, but it was not until a young man named Daryl Knight, a survivor, came forward with his story that anyone considered opening an inquiry. In January of 2000, Daryl Knight was driven out of the city of Saskatoon by police officers and abandoned without winter clothing. He had survived after knocking on a power plant door, and a worker who was inside had heard him and let him in to the warmth. Daryl was able to get home by calling a taxi, and he was eventually able to make a report about what had happened that night. Two other Indigenous men had been found deceased at that same power plant. Lloyd Dustyhorn was found the same month, and Rodney Nastis was found the day after Daryl Knight had come home. In addition, Lawrence Wegner was found nearby days later. Those other men, including the death of Neil Stonechild, who I'll speak about more in a moment, all had surface-level inquests conducted into their deaths. But the determinations of each were inconclusive, failing to determine the circumstances leading up to the deaths of these men. In the case of Daryl Knight, who survived, in an article by the St. Catherine Standard about his case, it says, quote, "Knight, who had several drinks that night, testified the officers pulled him from their cruiser and left him on the side of the road," end quote. In an interesting thesis by Liam Conway with the University of Regina about racial stereotyping in police, the author discusses about how this article in particular simultaneously introduces the common stereotype about Indigenous peoples and drinking, as well as an irrelevant fact. Whether or not Daryl Knight had been drinking before he was apprehended is irrelevant to the fact that he was abandoned in the countryside of Saskatoon. The intention here is to introduce some vague notion that perhaps it was Knight's fault for having been drinking, that he wound up deceased. Similarly, in the case of Sharon Maristy, every article I've read positions her to be drunk, at least at some point in the night, and inconsistently reports say that she was wasted by the time she was leaving the party. There were two officers involved in the kidnapping and essentially attempted murder of Daryl Knight. Constable Dan Hatchin and Ken Munson of the Saskatoon Police Service. However, they were only convicted of unlawful confinement and sentenced to 8 months in prison. Although it was pretty much just a slap on the wrist, it started something bigger. What the inquest into Daryl Knight, as well as the one into the death of Neil Stonechild started, was the birth of the understanding that, in the Canadian context, in the space of death, reality is up for grabs. What emerges from the inquiry into the death of Neil Stonechild and the inquest into what happened to Daryl Knight is a widespread collective indifference to Indigenous death, and the frozen fields of the countryside of Saskatoon become a place where that reality is up for grabs, a space where the law has authorized its own suspension, articulated beautifully in a 2014 article by Shireen Razak. Neil Stonechild was a young man who was not quite as lucky as Daryl Knight was. He was a Saulteaux First Nations teenager who died of hypothermia only shortly after he was picked up by the Saskatoon Police Service. Neil Stonechild was similarly positioned to be drunk beyond the capacity for orderly conduct. So when he was picked up by Saskatoon police officers, they already felt like they knew what they had to do. Neil was found deceased in the northwest end outside of the city, with odd marks on his wrists and what his family suspected to be a broken nose. According to Neil's friend, who was with him the night he was picked up, the last time he was seen alive, when he was picked up by police, he was already bleeding from his face. And even though investigations and inquiries into the death of Neil Stonechild revealed that officers would often drop Indigenous people off several blocks away from where they were picked up, typically in the countryside, typically in the wintertime, as a form of quote-unquote unarresting a person, the circumstances surrounding his death in the official inquiry remain inconclusive. For years, Saskatoon police insisted that these incidences were isolated. However, in 2003, only 3 years after the case of Daryl Knight, then Police Chief Russell Sabo admitted that it was possible police officers have been doing this for years, revealing that in 1976, one was disciplined, very leniently, if I may say so myself, for taking an Indigenous woman and dropping her off to the outside of the city, leaving her there. Reports that have come out since this revelation by investigative journalists have since positioned this young Indigenous woman to have been pregnant at the time, although I can't find any information about her. Like many suspicious ongoings within different police services across North America, the practice of Starlight Tour seems to be kept relatively under wraps. Although the concept itself is relatively well known, I would say, to some folks who go on their own learning journeys, such as myself, it is incredibly difficult to find any information detailing the cases of victims, and I find it suspicious that in the case of Sharon Maristy, where the circumstances leading up to her death are somewhat reminiscent of Starlight Tour practices, there is simply no information available about her or what happened to her or the police's investigation into her death. The only emergence of these practices in popular media today come from independent journalists and other forms of artistic expression. In a previous episode in this series, I believe I mentioned a song by the Puka Orchestra. It's called Cherry Beach Express. Cherry Beach is a beach in Toronto, here in Ontario, where I'm from. It's pretty far away from the main city, and it's surrounded by a few blocks of industrial development. Although there are buildings nearby, it's pretty far away from where people actually live. This song by the Puka Orchestra is One of the only detailings of a similar practice as the Starlight Tours being undertaken by the Toronto Police Service. Some of the lyrics read, "I got a bone to pick with you, not so friendly boys in blue. When you come out of the station and into the street, everybody beats a hasty retreat. Well, it was late one Friday and I'm a little bit wrecked. You're on your way to serve and protect. You buzz out of the cruiser like bees from a hive and ask me if I want to go for a drive. I tell you I'm innocent, I try to explain, but just making sure you don't do it again. That's why I'm riding the Cherry Beach Express. My ribs are broken and my face is a mess. That's why I'm riding the Cherry Beach Express, and I never dreamed it would be like this. That's why you're riding on the Cherry Beach Express. Your ribs are broken and your face is a mess, and we strongly suggest you confess." All you can ever find when researching the Starlight Tours are details of the cases that I'd briefly mentioned today. In addition, it's been alluded to in many articles that I've read that this practice is undertaken all across Canada. It's mostly targeted at Indigenous men, again predicated on that racial stereotype of heavy drinking and disorderly conduct, with the deeper issue rooted in past and present colonial efforts, being the assumption that Indigenous people are, quote, regulated by the presumption that they are not respectable citizens. Because who, after all, would willingly walk in sub-zero temperatures, inebriated and without proper clothing, and who would consider this activity safe, end quote, in the words of Shireen Razak. It would be unsurprising to me if Sharon Frances Maristy was a victim of the Starlight Tours practice. Although she was a woman, that doesn't seem to have stopped officers in the past. Similarly, she was of an appropriate age demographic. She was partaking in the similar types of activities that Saskatoon police officers were looking to predicate their attacks off of. And she was found dead in the cold, by herself, with the context clues pointing to the fact that she did not intend to really be out there for very long, if at all. And like many of the other cases, there's simply no more information about her. Sharon's friends and Sharon's family feel deeply in their hearts that she was wronged. Her own mother even said that she feels like someone left her out there to die. And yet once again, like many of the other cases, police's own inquiries are simply inconclusive. The latest high-profile Starlight Tour happened in only 2018, when an Indigenous man by the name of Ken Thomas said he was picked up by two officers on the 21st of April when he stepped outside of a bar to have a cigarette. Ken said he was detained and then driven south of the city of Saskatoon where he was dropped off. Thankfully, he wasn't too intoxicated really at all, and he was able to run back into the city and get home to stay warm. The Public Complaints Commission, with which Ken Thomas filed his formal complaint, said the accusations were quote-unquote unfounded, which is unfortunately expected, because again, censorship of Starlight Tours in the media is rampant. There's even evidence to suggest that Wikipedia articles about Starlight Tours and notable victims of them have been deleted several times, with internal investigations revealing that they were deleted via internal police computers. In the case of Sharon Maristy, I can only hope that if she is a victim of the Starlight Tours, that by speaking about this issue, I'm doing the most good that I can by raising awareness of it, especially in light of such rampant censorship. I'm hoping that as more people find out about this practice, maybe pressure is put on police services to be accountable to the deaths of First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people who are found frozen in remote areas. The onus is on the police services in Saskatoon and in Toronto, at the very least, to be more comprehensive and more thorough in their investigations of these freezing deaths. And it relates directly to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission of Canada's Call to Action Number 18, calling upon the federal, provincial, territorial, and Aboriginal governments to acknowledge that the current state of Indigenous health in Canada is a direct result of previous Canadian government policies, including residential schools, and to recognize and implement the healthcare rights of Indigenous people as identified in international law, constitutional law, and under the treaties. Even further, it relates to Call to Action Number 25, calling upon the federal government to establish a written policy that reaffirms the independence of the Royal Canadian Mounted Police to investigate crimes in which the government has its own interest as a potential or real party in civil litigation. Further, it relates to Call to Action Number 30, calling upon the federal, provincial, and territorial governments to commit to eliminating the overrepresentation of Indigenous peoples in custody over the next decade, and to issue detailed annual reports that monitor and evaluate progress in doing so. Lastly, it relates to Number 39, calling upon the federal government to develop a national plan to collect and publish data on the criminal victimization of Indigenous peoples, including data related to homicide and family violence victimization. It is only when a death such as the one of Sharon Maristy is fully investigated, and the details of such investigation are made publicly available, that we can know for certain that police are taking accountability for the history of the Starlight Tours, the ongoings of such practices, and their mandated duty to protect and serve, instead of hide their actions and try to justify their actions through racist stereotypes. I know it wasn't a long episode today, but I really wanted to talk about the Starlight Tours. And then when I discovered the case of Sharon Frances Maristy, I couldn't help myself. Although there's not a ton of information in her case, I thought it was really important to speak on because it may be that there's not a ton of information for a reason, and that reason may be the same reason that there's not a ton of information related to any of the victims of Starlight Tours in Canada's history. If you'd like to learn a little bit more about the Starlight Tours or the Saskatoon freezing deaths, I'll direct you to another podcast that I really, really enjoy called Canadian True Crime. It's episode 75. It's called Saskatoon Freezing Deaths. It's very comprehensive, and the host does an excellent job of storytelling in these cases. I commend her especially for working with such limited information. It's hard to say what happened to Sharon Maristy, but I hope for resolution in her case. And I hope that with continued public knowledge about these practices, that this kind of thing happens less and less. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Crimeopedia podcast. That's all for me today, and the next episode in the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women, Girls, and 2S Identifying Individuals series will be the last. Thank you for your patience with me as I've had to extend and sort of pause this series. I really did go into it intending to make it a much more involved and comprehensive series, but again, given everything going on, it's been really difficult to keep up, and so it did, you know, end up extending into 2024, but it's allowed me some more time to stew on some really important topics that I wanted to talk about and address them in the best way that I can. So with that, I'll see you here for the next episode, and until then, I'll have that other podcast episode linked on my website at crimeopediapod.ca, in addition to all of the other source material I used for this case. I'll see you next time.